Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the House Judiciary Committee. We apologize for our later start than even we had posted. We had a longer floor session than we expected. So we'll get right to business and open a public hearing on House Bill 2782. And do you want to get the sign-up sheet for that? Okay, why don't we have Mr. Tucker come up and bring your panel with you, if you would.
We handed it now.
I'm going to hold on to this until it makes sense. So, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Randy Tucker. I'm Legislative Affairs Director for 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I appreciate the opportunity to testify here today on House Bill 2782. With me today are Jim Just and Marilyn Reeves, and I'll let them introduce themselves at the appropriate time. 1,000 Friends of Oregon, as you know, is a private nonprofit organization founded in 1975 by Henry Richmond and Governor Tom McCall, and we work to improve, defend, and enforce our state and local laws that have been adopted to manage growth in Oregon's cities, towns, and countryside. One of the elements of our mission is ensuring a fair and open process for developing and carrying out land use plans and regulations. And the bill before you today fits in very well with that element of our mission, that it's focused on defending the opportunities for citizens to participate in the planning decisions that affect Oregon and their communities. Others here, Jim and Marilyn, can speak more authoritatively to the problem that this bill addresses. I'd like to offer some general introductory remarks about it. As you know, citizen participation is goal one of Oregon's statewide planning goals, and the system functions best when citizens participate in it at the local level. Land use appeals are the primary means of enforcing Oregon's land use planning laws and ensuring accountability for local decision makers. There's no land use police to guarantee that our land use laws will be faithfully implemented at the local level. Enforcement depends on appeals by applicants, other citizens, organizations, and sometimes by state and local government. Often the only people participating in a land use decision are average citizens. Again, this participation is a critical element of Oregon's land use system. It's counterproductive to place structural barriers in the way of citizens who want to participate in the decisions that are affecting their communities. So Senate Bill 378 would close a loophole in state law that allows certain local governments to discourage participation in the process by establishing prohibitively high fees for land use appeals. Most local governments have not done this, I should be very clear, but certain local governments have instituted fees upwards of $3,000. These are extreme examples, but even fees that are much lower than this can still constitute a serious barrier to participation. Let me just explain briefly the steps in the land use appeal process. An applicant goes to the counter and the staff gives them thumbs up or thumbs down. Either that applicant or other interested citizens may then appeal that decision to a hearings officer or a planning commission. There's a cap on the cost of that appeal, $250. That's in statute. That decision of the planning commission or the hearings officer can then be appealed to the local governing body, the city council or the county commission. And there is no cap on the cost of that appeal, and that is the problem that this bill addresses. If finally the local governing body makes their decision, and that final land use decision can be appealed to the Land Use Board of Appeals, there's a cap on that appeal of $325. But it's in that middle stage of the process that there is no limit, and fees vary widely, and we'd like to get some control on that. Last comment, or substantively, is that Senate Bill 378 is even-handed. It applies equally to applicants and to opponents of an application. Now, I said Senate Bill 378. There's an identical bill in the Senate called Senate Bill 378. So what I'm going to hand you now, just so that you've got it, is an amendment that was drafted for that bill, which is now the bill, by the way, is just sitting. And I thought this addresses a couple of issues that were raised with respect to that bill. First of all, a sort of a small tweak, but important, on page 1 in line 26. I'm not looking at the right bill. I hope it's in the same bill. Anyway, the reimbursement provisions down there in section C, bottom of the first page, apply in to transcript fees, and it was left pretty wide open so that, say, a Walmart that had some legal expenses in defending itself against a citizens group that didn't want them to locate could get reimbursed for all their expenses. We closed that one up with the Dash 1 amendments and also the Dash 2 amendments. Second, some citizens that came forward to testify last in the Senate noted that there's currently, this bill didn't address limited land use decisions, and so the rest of these amendments apply the same cap that is in the rest of the bill to limited land use decisions. With that, I'll turn this over to Mike.
Chair, can we get clarification on the amendments? I have the Dash 2, but I heard Randy say something about a Dash 1.
The Dash 1 is just the first four. The Dash 1 and the Dash 2, the first four lines are identical, and then everything from Section 4 in these amendments here is only in the Dash 2s. So the Dash 2s incorporate the Dash 1s.
Thank you.
But again, these are the amendments to Senate Bill 378. It's the same bill.
Right.
So, just for informational purposes.
Mr. Just, do you want to go next?
Sure. My name is Chair Williams, a member of the committee. My name is Jim Just, and I'm speaking on behalf of Friends of Linn County. Friends of Linn County is a community organization whose mission is to protect farm and forest land and to advocate for livable communities. And I have some written testimony that I'd like to distribute and discuss briefly. In the written materials that you're about to get, there's some just a first a two-page kind of summary of what the bill is, why it's needed, and what it does, followed by a two-page summary of some existing appeal fees that are charged by local governments around the state. Now, this is less useful than it might be because it's not very comprehensive, and there are some inaccuracies in it. However, it does give some idea of the range of fees that are currently charged around the state. The third item in this packet is a summary of the legislative history of this. These provisions. And lastly, there's a letter from a city council person from the city of Albany in support of the bill. Now, these provisions first arose in 1983 in response to a situation where a local government imposed a fee of $3,600 which had the effect of shutting a local citizens group out of the land use process. Oregon Shores Coastal Coalition then went to the legislature with this problem, and the legislature responded by passing a bill that provided that appeals fees, it dealt with two different elements. One, appeals fees and transcript costs. And the bill said that appeals fees shall be reasonable and shall not exceed the actual or average cost, and it applied that same language to transcripts, but also put a cap on transcript costs. And the transcript cost part of that legislative fix to that problem that arose in 1983 has worked very well. Originally, it was capped at $500, and then the applicant and the local government split everything thereafter. However, that was dropped later, and with the objective of minimizing the costs of these proceedings, the cap was kept. The provision for cost sharing over $500 was dropped, but the legislature then said, "Well, you don't have to fix. You could pay for your own transcripts if you're the appellant." And you don't need the whole transcript. You just pick the parts you want to talk about, and that's good enough. So the transcript part has worked pretty good. It's provided an incentive for local governments to keep costs down, is provided. The cap is bid, ensured that citizens will have the opportunity to participate without carrying an enormous financial burden. But however, the appeals fees part, which originally wasn't seen to be a problem, because at the time the original bill was passed, the fees were pretty reasonable. They were tended to be in the $100 area, and so that wasn't perceived as the problem. However, the language that's in statute simply hasn't worked. Local governments, when they're setting fees, don't go through the required inquiry of establishing that a fee is reasonable, or of computing actual or average costs and then saying, well, this is what the fee ought to be. It's quite common for a local jurisdiction simply to peg an appeal fee as a percentage of an initial application fee. For example, one half of the initial application cost, and there's no relationship established that the cost of an appeal has any relationship whatsoever to the cost of processing an application. So, particularly since local governments have gotten in financial binds over the last decade and are looking for other ways to raise funds, we're seeing more and more local jurisdictions raise these appeals fees with the unfortunate consequence of making it difficult or impossible for citizens to participate in those decisions that directly affect their lives. And this bill would fix that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Jess. We'll go ahead and wait on questions until we are done with the panel. Ms. Reeves?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Marilyn Reeves. I live outside Amity in Yamhill County. Serve as president of Friends of Yamhill County, and since 1994, our organization, we've been involved in a few appeals. So I think I understand the appeal process quite well, and I understand some of the problems. One issue that I really would like to have dealt with on the state level is to clarify that the local government shall refund or reimburse the land use appeal fees if the appeal is successful at the local level, or in the event it goes to LUBA, it's successful at the LUBA level. I have testimony that I will hand in, and I'm sorry I shouldn't have done it at the beginning, but in the interest of time I didn't, but I'll hand it in. I'll very quickly tell you one example that we had in McMinnville, which was a very interesting example. McMinnville is one of the cities in the state in which voters vote on annexations. And so in voting on annexations, when a developer comes in and says, I want to annex, 24 acres, 50 acres, whatever, it goes to Planning Commission. The Planning Commission rarely, if ever, turns it down. And then it goes, if the City Council wants to bring it up, it has to be an appeal. The appeal fee is $300. We had an example last year, and I gave you the correspondence to go with you, that rather interesting, in which we attempted to tell the City Planning Commission, you can't do this. This is an island. The City of McMinnville does not want to annex any more islands. Those are the ones that are outside and in that unincorporated area, and they're a mess, and they're a problem, and they have been. And the City of McMinnville, really, they have a few, and they don't want any more. However, the City Planning Commission said, well, voters can decide on this, and we did not think that this was an appropriate cost for the voters to, for the cost of running an election for this. And so we appealed it for $300 to the City Council. They held the appeal fee on a regular night. There were not hordes of people showed up. There were a few of us who pointed out that this was an island. City Council members were very cognizant of the problems island had caused in the past. And they then, with even the developer saying, Mr. Rudin saying, yes, this does create an island, and no, I probably shouldn't have brought this in, and so they turned it down. So it seemed to me it'd be slam dunk. I just send a letter and say, look, we'd like our $300 back. I sent the letter, and I never heard from the City of McMinnville. It was rather obvious they had no intention of giving us our $300 back. And yet that was not an extra cost to the city. There were no new staff papers prepared. There was no extra hearing. This part of state law, I think, clearly needs to be clarified. And the example that I'm giving you clearly is. Then I would like to talk very briefly about what happens in regard to appeals. Why do we even have to appeal? Well, sometimes we appeal because the application is quite incomplete and yet it gets approved. And sometimes we appeal because we find out that what the applicant said was the property line turns out not to be the property line. One interesting case in that regard, in which there was already a house, but by having the property line over here, in which he submitted the papers, that meant that he was attempting to say, no, the house really isn't on this property. Sometimes it's because the staff's in a hurry. But the main thing we want to preserve is that $250 fee in which we can appeal a staff decision. And when we appeal a staff decision, we believe that cap in law is appropriate. Now, if there's, and we have to appeal even to ask for a hearing. We've had to appeal simply because the staff hasn't made a decision and we don't know what they're going to do. And we've asked to have it heard by the Planning Commission. And there's no waiving of that when it does occur. So on the level of, Yamhill County does not have a problem at this present time of high exorbitant fees for those kinds of appeals of a plan after there's been a hearing. However, it was proposed. It was proposed for $750, and then they later agreed to $700, and then they later rescinded that. I think that they rescinded it because of the public outpouring and also because it did not appear to be reasonable or justified. We support the amendments that you have in front of you, and we do believe that there is need for state policy in this area and state guidance. And thank you very much for your attention.
Mr. Chair, may I add one very quick thing? Another amendment that we're contemplating, if we're able to move this bill, has to do with the refund provision that Marilyn alluded to. The bill does call for a refund of appeals fees to prevailing appellants. What it doesn't specify is, say you prevail at the local level but you lose at LUBA or you lose later in the process, whether you should have your refund anyway, and we're proposing some amendments that would clarify that and say that only if you prevail at the end of the process would you get that money refunded to you. Makes no sense to refund if you end up losing.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Tucker. Are there questions for this panel? No questions.
Who else do we have?
We're going to hear from Mr. Slack from AOC, Ms. Ludwig, and Mr. Clay are up next. Okay, thank you very much. We appreciate your coming down and testifying. So, with that pre-announcement, if we could have Mr. Slack, Ms. Ludwig, and Mr. Clay come forward. Why don't we start with you, Art, and work our way down from there?
Took the center seat, so I get to go first, huh?
That's it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Art Slack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties, and thank you for allowing me to testify this afternoon. The Association of Oregon Counties does not support House Bill 2782, and we did not support the look-alike bill in the Senate. So I just want to make those comments to you. We believe that the decision by a local government to set the second appeal fee is a local decision based on the guidance within the statute. And it's already been indicated that there is a cap of $250 on the initial appeal. And for those that have you that are in knowledgeable about land use, there is a whole series of different alternatives that local government have employed dealing with land use, and the hearings process, the decision-making process to get to hopefully a final decision in terms of land use. Some jurisdictions have chosen to do an initial decision sometimes administratively by the staff, sometimes it's by a hearings officer. In some jurisdictions, it's by a planning commission. If it's by a staff, it's appealable to either to a hearings officer usually or a planning commission. And then that decision can be appealed. So that's the second appeal that would go to the governing body. Maybe it's unique, but at least in a couple of counties within the state, the county commissioners have chosen not to be part of the quasi-judicial land use process. And decisions are final at the county at a hearings officer, and then they're appealable to LUBA. So there is only one appeal. The Planning Commission and the Board of County Commissioners in those count in the selected counties at this point that have made that choice are dealing with the policy questions, either in the comprehensive plan or the land use ordinances, and do not deal with the individual application or implementation of applications through the land use process. With respect to this particular bill, most counties at this point have appeal fees either initially or the second appeal fee that are either equal to what is being suggested or less than. However, we do have a few counties. Those are the counties that, as you can imagine, have not only rural areas but also urban areas and some more complex issues where the appeal fees as well as the initial application are greater than, let's say, $250. As an example, in Washington County, and they have a variety of appeal fees, they can approach almost $1,300 for appeal, a second appeal. And I know that in Deschutes County, a destination resort appeal approaches $3,000. But that's a very unique situation, and usually those are extremely controversial kinds of issues that do take a lot of time, of staff, and also of the governing body at this point. We have had a couple of meetings with the proponents of this bill, and I have suggested that we would be supportive of an amendment that would require the local jurisdictions to hold a public hearing with respect to it, the establishment of its appeal fees based on the language that's currently in state statutes to assure that appeals would be reasonable, that they're no more than the average cost or the actual cost of the appeals that are incurred at this point. And that public hearing would allow citizen groups to come forward and question in a public discussion the establishment of those fees. The other thing, and I almost said this somewhat tongue-in-cheek, Mr. Chair, but another alternative, if the legislature wishes to cap the appeal fees, would have the state pick up the difference between the cap and the true cost that local government would go through a process again to establish. We'd certainly be open to that.
Well, Mr. Slack, that's always that consistent helpfulness the counties seem willing to offer. Ms. Ludwig?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As you, Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities, as you heard from Mr. Schlack, local governments handle their appeal fees in many different ways. Some cities charge and some do not charge these appeal fees. Some have a small set fee. Some charge a percentage of the original application fee. Some of our jurisdictions don't charge appeal fees at all. Some of them don't charge transcript fees, or some require a deposit to cover the preparation in lieu of a fee. Some of our larger jurisdictions that do have a percentage of their application fee provide a free appeal fee to neighborhood associations. That's very true across the board for some of those larger jurisdictions. And in some cities, currently, the fee is refunded if the decision is reversed. In most cases, an LOC has done a survey of all the cities, of a large percentage of the cities across the state, These fees, as you've heard in the counties, are relatively small. And in jurisdictions where they are larger and when they are based on an application fee or a percentage of, and generally have free neighborhood association fees, there are relatively few, if any, appeals. And most of those jurisdictions, most of these appeals are from applicant developers who basically are objecting to conditions of approval. And basically what we're looking at there is an officially sanctioned negotiation process, the result of which is often compromised, but generally not finding error. These appeals are intended to achieve a financial benefit, such as a reduction of minimum standards or reduction in exactions. And essentially, if we look at a cap in this situation, this would be a subsidy to developers. The cost to local government in this bill is substantial, not in overall dollar amounts, but in the reduction of fees. Most of our local governments are not actually reimbursed full costs by these appeal fees. Most of them are in the 40 to 60% range currently. So this bill would cost local governments some money. The fee process isn't uniform and has very different implications, small jurisdictions versus larger jurisdictions. And if the problem is truly that a local jurisdiction is setting inappropriately high appeal fees, the League would concur with the suggestion that the counties put forward. Let's do this and ensure that this is a public process locally where those fees can be looked at and debated and set by their local officials. Thank you.
Thank you, Linda. Mr. Clay.
Chair Williams and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Clay. I'm a chief planner with the City of Portland Bureau of Planning. I'm also here today representing our Bureau of Development Services, which processes our land use review applications. Appreciate the opportunity to explain the impact of House Bill 2782 on the City of Portland. I'll be brief. We have some significant concerns, and they primarily go to the area of cost. And as a result, today we can't support House Bill 2782. I brought with me and I handed out a copy of the City of Portland's zoning code, and it's an excerpt from the section that deals with fees, Chapter 33750. I think it is somewhat instructive to keep in mind the distinctions that occur today in the statute for certain kinds of land use decisions. You'll notice under 33750.030, land use procedures, under point C that talks about appeal fees, we have specifications for type 3 procedures and those for type 2. The type 2 procedures are basically those that already follow the statute today and are today limited at $250 with the opportunity for a waiver for certain recognized organizations. I also wanted to point out that primarily in C1, which I think is what we're talking about today, which Art referred to as the second hearing, which we would refer to as a type 3 procedure, that we require an appeal fee be one-half of the total application fee of the original land use review request, but we have an appeal fee waiver process for recognized organizations. Those recognized organizations in the City of Portland are neighborhood associations. We have about 100 neighborhood associations in the city. We've had this provision in our code for many, many years now, and we think it works fairly effective to allow for a certain level of fee waivers to go forward and a certain level of appeals to occur without any cost. And what we think it does for us is it provides for a public forum and an opportunity for individuals, whether they be adjoining property owners or neighborhood organizations that are concerned about specific policy provisions, to go ahead and appeal those decisions directly to City Council. However, other appellants, we do think it's very, very important that we charge them because, there is a cost, and two, we don't think it's appropriate in every instance to give somebody a free ride appeal onto city council. These become very labor-intensive, and they are very costly. So we balance the two objectives. We think if there are individuals that can make a reasonable case before the neighborhood association and use that public forum as an opportunity and a filter, our city council is willing to hear those decisions. On page 2, 750-2 of the code, you'll see the specifics of the fee waiver provision under A, and number 2 is the type 3 appeal, and it just specifies the type of recognized organization that we're talking about, refers to the other part of the code, and indicates that the appeal is being made on behalf of the recognized organization, and it simply has to be signed off on by the chairperson of the organization or somebody else acting on their behalf. So again, we think this is a good opportunity for us. Our applications for these type 3 are of the highest land use order. In other words, we have types 1, 2, and 3, and as you move up the scale in terms of the level of review, the level of findings that are required, the intensiveness of the staff work, the things that are required in that process, whether they be a wetlands mitigation study, a traffic or transportation study, become fairly complex fairly quickly. The kinds of things we're talking about for a Type 3 land use review are things like master plan applications for colleges or universities or hospitals or church facilities or other large institutions within the city, including airports. So they're a fairly high order, and it's not uncommon for those to be appealed. And just in closing, just so you have a sense of the numbers, at least for the city of Portland, in 2002 we had 10 appeals from our hearings officer to city council. Half of those, five of them, were appeal waivers. In other words, they were free, and the other half did have to pay the appeal waiver. In 2001, we had 8 appeals from the hearings officer to city council, and 6 of those were waived, or 6 of them were free. We do hold a hearing when we adjust our fee schedule, so we go through that process now with our city council. Typically, we review our fee schedule about every 2 years currently. So with that, I'll close, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there questions for any of the witnesses on this panel? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2782. We're going to jump down on the agenda now and open a work session on House Bill 2048. Representative Anderson, do you want to take the chair, and I'll invite up your constituent, Mr. King, too, if he's here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Courtney Anderson, representative of District 3 in Grants Pass and the Illinois Valley. Over the last few years, you have, I think, heard a plea from one of my constituents to consider removing from the record in some instances a conviction that has been made. As you know, I think Representative Carl Wilson, who preceded me, had testified with you, and we just felt there was enough in this case that it needed to be heard again. Representative Wilson requested that this be brought, and then as I heard the circumstances, I felt like he did, that my constituent, Mr. King, should come and present his side of the view to you. So I bring to you Robert King.
Hello, Mr. Chairman and committee. My name is Robert King. This bill here that I kind of worked up with Representative Wilson and Anderson started out 16 years ago. I got a felony driving while suspended. Well, the law at that time was if you had 3 driving while suspended, they automatically felony revoked your license. That law is no longer in effect. The fallout of this is that I still have a felony on my record. I work for Josephine County Mental Health System now. I have not been able to get on with the state in any OIA system because of this felony. I looked up, I researched the law, I went to my DA, I went to lawyers, I went to the judge, even asked for a set-aside. There was no law for him to set aside a traffic offense off of a criminal record. Somehow, my traffic offense went over to my criminal record. DMV has since dropped it. It's still on my criminal record. There is no law that will allow me to expunge this off my record. I just wanted to plead with you to try to get this changed. In my research, I called the state police, and talking with them, they have calls between one and three people daily, almost on the same circumstances that I have.
All right, are there questions for Representative Anderson or Mr. King? Representative Brzezinski.
Thank you, Mr. King. I just want to make sure I understand your concern. Is it that you want to be able to expunge your record completely to have the felony removed, or is it because you want to have relief so you can have access to firearms?
I want to have it expunged because it's detrimental to me for my job placement. I am moving up, and I'm trying to get a master's degree. And to be a therapist, you cannot have a felony on your record.
Mr. Chair,
Mr.
King mentioned to me that in the process of looking at all of the different possibilities, he has talked to the governor's office, and they've offered him papers on clemency, so maybe have this taken care of. Was that kind of the direction you were leading, Representative Brzezinski?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I guess when we heard this bill before, I had taken notice as to some individuals were concerned about being able to get relief for firearms. I know there is a procedure where individuals can do that. It's true that under our current expungement laws or motions to set aside a judgment, all traffic offenses are not expungible. And so that's a policy decision that I'm not sure why it was made or whatever, but it's been discussed before as to whether we should look at some limitations on how it's applied and maybe certain relief for certain ones after a number of years have passed. I know that DMV has had some issues because of habitual offender requirements that are currently that would be contradictory depending on when you had the expungements take place, and it may be certain ones such as your constituents for felony driving may be or should be looked at differently than other type of felony driving offenses.
Further questions? Yes, Representative Barker.
Thank you. Somebody, when I first was down here at the beginning of the session, maybe you can answer me. Somebody said there's people proposing a bill so that somebody convicted of negligent homicide in a traffic accident, drunk driving, or whatever, could then get that expunged. Would this bill apply to that?
Mr. Chairman, Committee, Mr. Representative Barker. What I'm looking at is that this felony that was imposed on me, a felony, the culpable state of a felony is against person or property, which I did neither. It was against the state. I think people that do homicide, I believe, should have the felony still there in place. I don't think they should have relief from this. I'm looking at people that didn't do any person or property crimes, which a felony is culpable state of.
Okay, so if I may. So,
you may.
What we're looking at here is driving convictions for felony driving convictions that are more like administrative violations for too many suspended convictions or something like that, but not the fourth drunk driving conviction or third drunk driving conviction. Would they be able to get that expunged?
Thanks.
That's not your. I mean, from your hesitancy, I think that's not your intent. But I would be concerned if that was covered. I don't want that part.
Representative Shirley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just an observation that I think in a lot of cases, I think felony driving while suspended does have a culpable mental state. I mean, sometimes the hardest ones to get a hold of are the people who just will not quit driving, and that's why we have degrees there. And I guess the other one that comes to, and I'm not arguing, I'm not arguing against this in terms of concept. I think this statute always gives us headaches when we start to try to rebuild this thing from the center out. But the other one that comes to mind is DUIs, and I know we've been dealing with elevating DUIs, you know, over the number of convictions to a certain felony status. And I guess as I see this, at least as drafted, this would allow a person to expunge a DUI convictions, which would undo the work we've been doing to get to DUIs. So it begins to call to mind all of the headaches that we have in whenever we try to do this. I mean, it seems straightforward enough when you have a specific case in mind, but then to draft the statute so that you don't open up the door to all sorts of other cases that you don't want to be able to expunge. It's very hard.
Mr. Chairman and committee, I realize that what you're saying, however, is that you have to, before you have any expungement even proceed, you have to have a period of time that you have no offenses committed.
Right.
So being so, after 10 years, I would see that wouldn't affect even a person that had a DUI, let's say 10 years prior after that and had no record of that. That means his state has changed too at that point. I mean,
well, there's a when you move into the DUII issue, there's just a whole different tenor, and I think there are a lot of people who frankly would have a one strike and you're out for the rest of your life on being able to drive ever on that particular crime. And so it does change the nature of, I think, our ability to be successful. This isn't the first time that this committee has had to struggle with the expungement statute in general, and it may be appropriate at some point to ask the Oregon Law Commission, for example, to take a look at some sort of a comparative with other states on how they handle expungement, because it is a very difficult statute, and we have struggled with it on regular occasion. Representative Przanski.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I guess from Mr. King's understanding, the way the DUI, the issue that we have, it's really twofold. One, if you have multiple convictions within a 10-year period, can be used for elevating it as a felony.
Right.
And so you're correct if you look at it in that concept, that you could, in fact, after 10 years, not be using that to penalize someone as a felony. But we also have four convictions, and we do not have a time going back, the length of time, for the type of punishment they would receive. And it can, in fact, be greater than 10 years period of time for a conviction to elevate it for sanctions.
All right. Are there any further questions for
Mr. Chair?
Representative Anderson?
Yeah, because of the limitations of time now in front of us, maybe your suggestion of either the Law Commission or a work group to study this during the interim would be good to bring all of these issues together and maybe bring it back in 2 years.
We'll put it on the list of interim projects, Representative.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, no, I agree with that. I've talked about this with Representative Anderson, and this is true. About once or twice a session, we get bills that try to amend this expunction statute, and it is just such a morass that it's almost impossible without starting over again, I think, to make sense or to make any effective change in this, because there are just too many tripwires built into this statute with all of the language and the exceptions and the exceptions to the exceptions. It's just a snake pit.
Mr. Chair, I would agree with what Representative Shetterly said for all the reasons he said. It is one of the worst ones I've seen in the criminal code to attempt to try to tackle. And I think it's as bad, if not worse, than the venue one that we were able to kind of get our hands around. Because, I mean, there are so many exceptions on top of exceptions, and it would be great to be able to clean it up and have something a little bit more straightforward and take into consideration some of these other concerns and pitfalls that may not be necessary or intended.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. King. We appreciate you coming up to testify. Representative Anderson, we're going to close the work session on House Bill 2048. While we're in the business of work sessions, I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 3015. Counsel, can you bring us up to speed on that one?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 3015, if you recall, deals with establishing procedures to protect the confidentiality of Social Security numbers and is giving the presiding judge of each judicial district authority to do so in certain domestic relations proceedings. We have now in front of us -2 amendments, which I believe should be the operable set.
And I just found the note that said that we're supposed to call Representative Johnson. who's in, who's in room 170. Yeah, if you could just call her office so they're aware.
Jim, you going to go down and get her? Of course, I just got the dash twos this morning, so it would be helpful if somebody could come up and explain exactly what they do. But I believe that they're consensus amendments.
Who's here on the dash two amendments? Representative
Brad.
Okay. All right. And is that the county clerks I see, too?
It is.
All right. County clerks and Mr. Swank, why don't you come forward? And this book came to us from the Department of Justice, is that right?
Nope.
Have I got the wrong bill?
Yes. Johnson.
It's Representative Johnson's. All right. Okay, why don't you go ahead, Mr. Swank?
So, this does. Yeah, but it's. Okay. Chair Williams, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swank. I'm with the state. I'm special counsel for government relations for the state court administrator's office. When this bill was last before you, we pointed out, as we had to Representative Johnson's office, and she was the sponsor, that all the bill in its original form did was to keep Social Security numbers out of pleadings in domestic in dissolution and summary dissolution cases, and our thought was that she was probably attempting to keep Social Security numbers from becoming public records in those kind of cases altogether. We indicated to you that those Social Security numbers end up in the judgments and we end up sending them to the Bureau of Vital Records. We worked with Representative Johnson's office. We think the Dash 2 amendments are more in the form that she wants, because they accomplish what we believe to be the original purpose of the bill and take for dissolution and summary dissolution cases, take the Social Security number also out of the judgment and make it confidential in the vital records portion and have us put the state court administrator, as opposed to every presiding judge, establish a procedure for the courts to keep those records confidential and to set a separate have it be in a separate document so we can keep it confidential. I just got the amendments this morning also and sent them out to people as I did, but that's the theory, that you've actually in these kinds of cases made some, put something together that probably keeps these confidential rather than just taking them out of the pleadings. And it's not our bill, but we thought if you wanted to do it, at least it should work. And it goes day forward for records, and it doesn't relate to the legacy records or records before the date of the effective bill or actions that were filed before then. And that's primarily just a cost issue. It costs millions of dollars to hire people to go back through old records and redact things. So we worked on the amendments, and that's what you have with the Dash 2. And you may have found a problem with them. The county clerks may have found a problem.
Mr. Stern?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Charles Stern. I'm the Yamhill County Clerk, and I'm representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks. In addition to the actions in the court dealing with dissolutions, beginning in Section 8, it also addresses the marriage records and goes forward with those at the State Vital Records Center. For a number of years, the form has been collecting that data. But at the county level, we do not capture and maintain those Social Security numbers. So those numbers are being passed on to the state without being retained at the county level and have been for a number of years. So it's only the very old Social Security records that would, old marriage records that would show any Social Security numbers in the clerk's records. The one area that so those dealing with marriage records that really have no, we're not at all concerned about it by county clerks. In Section 10 of the bill, it talks to divorce records in the custody of a county clerk, a county recorder, or the state court shall be completed and maintained in accordance with proceedings outlined in Section 1. And Section 1 of the bill kind of addresses the filing of these kinds of actions. And we don't do that. We're kind of a secondary collector of that. And I think that under Section 1, if the courts do the Section 1, then what might be filed in the land records at some later date would be a judgment that would not have Social Security numbers, because the Social Security numbers are filed on a separate sheet as provided in Section 1 of the proposed amendment. So that it takes that out automatically, because we don't file them, they don't come to us until kind of a secondary response as a transcript from one county to the other to create liens on real property. So I think in Section 10, the issue of the clerk or the recording officer, the county completing and maintaining in accordance with the procedures of one doesn't really fit, because we don't do anything that's outlined in Section 1 of these proposed amendments.
So if I understand you, Mr. Stern, you're saying that county clerks and a county recording officer ought to come out of Section 10.
That's kind of how I view that. Yeah.
All right. Great. Welcome, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate your patience. Coming in as I am without any context of the previous witness's testimony, let me just remind the committee that the genesis of this bill is a sitting circuit court judge who was also a prosecutor, and after his successful prosecution of a case, found the defendant rifling through available public records to gain information about the judge. And given the defendant's violent prior record, my constituent, the judge, I think is justifiably concerned. The intent of this bill was never to be retroactive, and I think that was one of the early concerns that has now been addressed by the amendments. Also, the intent was never to be a burden on the Judicial Department or on local government, and we have tried hard to work with them and thank Mr. Swank for his cooperation. Conversely, we didn't want to create any unintended consequences for legitimate business people. I've just received these amendments. They're under review by several folks, both in my office and one industry group that had some concerns about unintended consequences on their professional activities. I would like the bill to move ahead with my commitment that after further review, if these amendments are burdensome or are not satisfactory, that I would cooperate fully to accommodate any concerns. And it may be that you've already worked it all out in my absence. And
oh, I don't know. I'd go that far.
Hope burns eternal, Mr. Chair.
Representative Prozanski.
Mr. Chair, I guess looking at what the concerns were from the county clerks, it seems to me that if the chair is willing to move the amendments forward, we could do that instead of holding it up to just have those five or six words taken out, knowing that that can be done on the Senate side, because basically just would be lining out on the bottom of page 19, line 30, continuing to the first three words, it looks like on the top of page 20.
We don't do anything.
And it sounded like this, at least the state courts are satisfied with the amendments to their review, and the county clerks are satisfied if that one section comes out. And I'm not sure about what else or other interest groups that are involved here, but it seems like it's close enough to maybe move it forward, knowing our time schedules.
Yeah, Representative Johnson, is this something that, you know, a couple of additional days, you think you'd know the answer to these questions, or do you think it would take longer than that?
Oh, no, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I feel quite confident that even a couple of hours might help resolve it. A couple of days would be very satisfactory.
Yeah, I think we're in okay shape to give everyone the chance to sort of run the trap line on 3015-2 amendments, just to make sure that they are what we think they are, and we can post this up for, even put it on our Wednesday evening agenda, and that'll give you an opportunity. And if there's a couple of little fixes, like the one that was just mentioned, I'd suggest that you get down to Legislative Council and see if we can put a draft 3 together so we don't have to conceptually amend if we can avoid it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your patience with this.
You bet. Is there anybody else here on 3015-2s that feel a need to speak?
Yeah.
Okay. If not, and that'll give you, Brad, a chance to also more fully review the amendments. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Then that's fine. Then we'll go ahead and close the work session on 3015, and we'll put it back on the agenda for Wednesday, likely on the evening part of the agenda. And Representative Shetterly, are we ready for 33?
I think we're ready to talk about them, Mr. Chair. Pete identified one shortfall in the draft that we got back today. We may be able to deal with it in a conceptual
manner. All right, let's try it. We'll open a work session on House Bill 3330. And why don't you come forward,
well, this is the one,
Mr. Shepard. And Council, why don't you remind us about what this is about?
Sure, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. House Bill 3330 authorizes the governor to proclaim an act of war, terrorism, or sabotage has caused the death of an unknown person. Basically, that would allow a death certificate to be issued for that person so heirs and survivors could obtain assets, insurance, and other things so that they could move on with their lives. Last time we heard this bill, if I remember correctly, we talked about having natural disasters added to this one. And I have not been working on the amendments. It's my understanding that Pete and Representative Shetterly have done so.
Okay. Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Council recalls the discussion correctly. There were two elements of the committee's discussion, as I recall. One, broadening the bill to potentially include natural disasters, and two, integrating the bill's provisions with an existing chapter for the administration of absentee persons, the estates of absentees, and that the amendments, the dash one amendments that just became available to Representative Shetterly and me a short time ago accomplish one of those two things, that is the conformity with Chapter 117. The bill, the amendments also eliminate the restriction that would in the printed bill have required the catastrophic event to have occurred within Oregon to address an issue that the committee discussed. The Dash 1 amendments do not, however, broaden the bill to extend to natural disasters as well as acts of war, terrorism, or sabotage. And I think that must have been a miscommunication between me and Legislative Council, in as much as that was part of what Representative Shetterly and I had scratched out in a handwritten form of the bill. So that piece of it didn't make it into the Dash 1 amendments.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Again, if you and the committee are inclined, I think we could make a conceptual amendment on line 4 of the bill, where it says the governor may proclaim that we could insert a natural disaster or...
Right. The language we talked about, I think, previously had been catastrophic natural disaster. Do you think you need catastrophic in there?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think if we're talking about a natural disaster that's caused the death of unknown persons, probably by definition it'd be catastrophic, so I don't know that it would be necessary to have that modifier.
And otherwise you're satisfied with the effects of the dash ones, Representative Shetterly?
There's one other, again, this is that time, but if you look on lines 6 to 10, what it says is that if you have an absentee estate, the court can order the state medical examiner to issue a death certificate if the presumption established by Section 2 applies, and that's the circumstances we're talking about here, natural disaster, war, terrorism, sabotage. I think what I had intended when I put this forward was that we authorize the court to order a death certificate in any absentee estate, once you've established to the satisfaction of the court that a person is deceased, there's no reason not to have a death certificate issue. And I don't think that the cause of death or the circumstances under this bill are necessarily more persuasive than any other that would justify the issuance of a death certificate. And so if you are inclined, we could also conceptually amend the dash ones simply to say, on line 8, put a period after the word estate. And that way, then, the ability to obtain an order issuing a death, directing issuance of a death certificate would apply in any absentee estate. And the reason that might come up is that you might have real property that needs to be administered on, so that you want to do that through an absentee estate, but there may also be life insurance, there may be a pension plan, there may be some other asset that for the purpose of transfer requires, usually for some out-of-state transfer agent, a death certificate. And just an order in an absentee estate saying someone has died doesn't cut it for those New York transfer agents that have their rules about what they require. And so, you know, if we wanted to make this available for all absentee estates, and I think it makes sense, we could just end the sentence there, and then that availability of a death certificate would be available in all absentee estates.
Let me ask, though, Representative, what is the current standard? In other words, this assumed an event which, based on the facts and circumstances, there was just going to be some pretty decent evidence that you weren't going to be able to find this person, as opposed to currently, you know, another absentee situation where someone, you know, disappears and is gone, and there's some question about the possibility of fraud or abuse of that process. I mean, is there some insurance that we're not expanding it or widening it in a way that's not going to create sort of an opportunity for mischief?
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess in response to that, the protections in that case are built into Chapter 117, where the court requires proof of the circumstances of death and can conduct a hearing if the court has any questions and require affirmative proof of death. I mean, so those protections are already in place. I mean, the same opportunity, I suppose, for mischief occurs. You don't need a death certificate, for instance, to get a piece of property transferred to an absentee estate. But you can get it done with the proper proof to the court satisfaction that a person has died. I guess just we're just acknowledging here by this, if we do this, that proof to the court is satisfactory for all purposes.
So you don't really view it as a policy expansion?
No, I really don't.
Okay, all right. Pete, what do you think about that? That's a bit broader than your original intent in the bill. Does the department have a position?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, no, we don't oppose that. As I explained to the committee, the original motivation for the bill arose directly out of the September 11th experience. I should add that at the committee's request, I did contact the Oregon State Bar section on probate law and sent materials concerning the bill to Mr. Chris Klein, who told me that he forwarded those to the members of the section. And I don't have authority to speak for the section, of course, but he indicated to me that at least in its original conception, the members didn't anticipate any difficulty. He did indicate to me that to the extent it became broader, it would be more likely to engage concerns from the bar. But that's the only feedback I can give to the committee.
Okay. Okay. So we'll be dealing with essentially two conceptual amendments.
You want a motion?
Sure. We're in work session. Let's do it. Why don't we start with the bill proper?
Okay. Mr. Chair, I would move conceptual amendment of House Bill 3330 as follows on line 4, following the word that, insert a natural disaster or.
Representative Shetterly has moved a conceptual amendment to House Bill 3330 on line 4, adding the words following the word that, quote, a natural disaster or, close quote. Is there discussion on the motion? Is there objection?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Crummell.
As far as a punctuation, should there be a comma following that as well?
Mr. Chair.
Do we get into that?
Looking at, if you look on the further down the line where it says terrorism or sabotage, I think LC doesn't use commas with
you're
or.
Right. Thank you.
Okay. No objection. The conceptual amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
I move that we conceptually amend the dash one amendments as follows. On line 8, inserting a period after the word estate, and deleting the remainder of line 8 and line 9 and line 10.
Representative Shetterly moves a conceptual amendment to the dash 1 amendments for House Bill 3330, following the word estate on line 8 of the amendment, inserting a period and then deleting the remainder of line 8, all of line 9, and all of line 10. Is there a discussion on that motion? Representative Brzezinski.
I don't know if it's necessary for LC, but should we put the quotes at the end after a state as how they set off or what's being added? I don't know if we need to do that or not for these conceptual amendments.
No, we never worry about quotes, do we? But
we typically don't.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I think we're fine. They'll put the quote in whether we say to or not, if it's the right place to go.
Yep.
All right. So the motion is to adopt that conceptual amendment. Any objection? Okay, the conceptual amendment has been made to the dash ones.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
I move the dash ones as conceptually amended to House Bill 3330.
Representative Shetterly moves the dash one amendments as conceptually amended to House Bill 3330. Is there discussion? Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, there was some discussion earlier about using the word the state of Oregon. Did that need to be inserted as well?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Sherrill.
I think we took care of that by deleting the language within this state. That's done by the dash one amendments.
Okay. Right. Okay. All right. So the motion is to move the bill as conceptually amended to the floor. Further discussion? And
no, actually, that was the adoption of the dash ones, I think.
Oh, was it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
The dash ones are adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Now, there we go.
Thank you. I move House Bill 3330 as amended by the dash one amendments, including the conceptual amendment, and as conceptually amended on line 4 to the floor of the DuPass recommendation.
What Representative Shetterly said is their discussion.
Yes, I have a question.
Yes, Representative Ackerman.
I just had a question regarding, it's really to anyone, on line 5 of the bill, cause of death of unknown persons. I was wondering why that phrase unknown persons. Should it not be any person? How would you establish the death of an unknown person?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, I think that the use, first of all, that this is the phrase used in the New Jersey legislation on which this was modeled. That's the initial reason, but I think it's intended to capture the concept that we're dealing here by definition with a situation in which we don't know, we haven't recovered the remains of all of the persons whom we believe to have died. Therefore, it is unknown exactly who all perished in the event. So for the purposes of the particular proceeding here in respect to the governor's proclamation, the governor simply proclaims, in effect, I know that a number of people died in this event, but I cannot now say exactly who they may be, okay. May have been, rather.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Sherrill.
I think that's where the tie into Chapter 117 comes in, because then it would be a matter for the personal representative of the estate to identify a particular missing person as... connect them with this event that has caused these deaths, and then that's why I think it was helpful to have the connection between that proclamation and Chapter 117.
Okay. So the motion is to move the bill to the floor as amended and call the roll.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Trumbull?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative
Brzezinski?
Aye.
Representative
Shetterly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 3330 is amended, moves to the floor with a DuPass recommendation. Representative Shetterly, will you carry it?
Sure.
Thank you. We don't have anyone signed up to testify on House Bill 3385. Is there anyone here for that bill? All right, I'm going to open a public hearing and close a public hearing on House Bill 3385. We'll next go to House Bill 3346. I'll open a public hearing on that bill and ask Mr. Riggs, and I'm not sure I can read the writing. Is it Graham?
Garahan.
On the last one to come forward.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Doug Riggs, here today representing Metro. Very much appreciate your time today for what might seem like a relatively insignificant bill. We at Metro have had a long-standing policy in working with the state and our regional partners to try to enforce regional dumping provisions in the Tri-County area and the Portland area. And unfortunately, as statute has changed over the years, we've discovered that our underlying statute needs to be integrated a little more carefully with the state statute. I think I've discussed this with most of you prior, so we don't want to take up a lot of the committee's time. I would ask Paul Garahan, who's the associate Metro attorney, maybe give you just a quick summary of why we need the bill, and then we'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Paul Garahan, assistant Metro attorney. Metro's code was first adopted in 1978 regarding enforcement, administrative enforcement, and how to then enforce civil penalty orders that Metro enters as a result of its administrative enforcement actions. At the time, it was modeled after the state administrative rules for taking enforcement action. What we realized recently in looking back at this, having a number of cases coming through our enforcement now, is that state law has changed quite a bit since 1978. The bulk of, or a lot of, the Administrative Procedures Act code has been adopted at the state level, and what the Metro Code was patterned after was how state administrative agencies enforce their civil penalty orders. The changes, a lot of the changes to that part of state law called into question, and changes to what types of orders county clerks can enter as judgments, called into question whether Metro's code and Metro's authority was sufficient to enforce its civil penalty orders. So what this does is, this language mimics language that's in the State Administrative Procedures Act for enforcement of state agency civil penalty orders. And this just clarifies and ensures that Metro has the authority to enforce its civil penalty orders in the same way that, for example, the state DEQ could enforce civil penalty orders.
Is that it?
Yes, sir.
Are there questions for the panel? Okay. For thank the, you. Oh, counsel?
For the committee, my SMS was done today. It was a guess as to what this was about. You're all looking at it thinking, this is not the bill we're hearing. But
close enough.
Close enough.
Okay. No questions? We'll close the public hearing and open a work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brzezinski.
House Bill 3346 has presented to us to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Brzezinski moves House Bill 3346 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion on this motion? Call the roll, Ann.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Crummell?
Excuse.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Brzezinski?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 3346 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative McPherson, by the brisk manner in which you removed your glasses,
yes.
I assume that you're interested in carrying this bill.
I'd be delighted to carry this bill.
Being a Metro representative.
Then you shall. All right, finally, public hearing on House Bill 3362. And I'll ask David Madigan to come forward.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is David Madigan, and I'm with the law firm of Cooney & Crew, and my law firm represents the Oregon Medical Association. And I'm here today in support of House Bill 3362 as an amendment to the physician or hospital physician lien law. And House Bill 3362 is intended to remedy a problem with the current version of the hospital physician lien law, and that some insurance companies have been misapplying the process for prorating funds among shareholder or lien holders when there are insufficient limits of insurance to satisfy all liens. and what we hope that this amendment will do is we'll clarify Section 3 of the law and make it clear that they're required to prorate that limit of insurance among all lien holders who have filed valid liens within the 30-day time period, so everyone gets a fair share of the limits of insurance for their services rendered. As the law is currently written, the insurance companies interpret the language available funds in Section 3 to mean the funds that they have at that time. So what some insurance companies have done is as soon as a lien comes in from a hospital or a physician, they pay that lien in full, and as soon as all the limits are exhausted, any other valid liens that are served within the 30-day time period, they deny them, saying our funds, the limits are exhausted, there's nothing left, sorry. And what we think House Bill 3362 will do is change the language where they no longer have that loophole of the phrase available funds. I looked at the version of the bill today, and I would suggest one change to that. On line 27, some of the proposed language says amounts available under the limits of insurance. And the problem that we've had with the language of the current bill is the use of the term available. And this is how the insurance companies are interpreting this law, so as they don't have to collect all the liens, all the validly filed liens, wait the 30-day time period, and then prorate the limits of insurance so everybody gets a fair share. They don't want to administer that. They just pay it as it comes in, and most likely the hospital will be the first one to get their lien filed, and then the physicians that rendered emergency services won't see any compensation for the time that they spent in rendering the services. What we would suggest is removing the language amounts available under, so the amendment reads, starting with line 27, the insurer making the payment shall prorate the limits of the insurance, and we believe that will remedy this problem. I've also prepared, sorry, I should have handed this out earlier, written testimony.
Are there questions? Does that conclude your remarks, Mr. Madigan?
That would be my remarks, yes.
Okay. Are there questions for Mr. Madigan about this bill? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a time period that you suggest?
Yes, yes. The physician, hospital physician lien law is several different laws, and one of them provides that the perfection of the lien itself, that once the patient is discharged from the hospitals and physicians that provided those services while the patient was an inpatient have 30 days from the date of discharge to properly file the lien in the local county and serve the lien on the insurer. So once the patient's discharged, the hospital and the physicians have 30 days in which to complete this to then have a valid lien. So the insurance companies won't have to wait more than 30 days after the date that their insured was discharged from the hospital to know who had a valid lien and what to prorate it at.
Representative Pozanski.
So it sounds to me that the hospitals and the physicians who treated someone do not have to first request payment before they file a lien. This sounds like standard procedures after 30 days or after discharge.
It's after discharge, and usually it's PIP funds. It's the personal injury protection funds, and this is the way that generally where this comes about is you know, a serious auto accident. Mm-hmm. The insured is immediately transported to a hospital. A private physician who has privileges at the hospital is called in to perform using an emergency procedure. And then at that time, after the patient's discharged, then the hospital generally files its lien against the PIP funds for the services that it was rendered, or it rendered, and then also physicians do the same. But hospitals know when patients are discharged, and they have a very good system already in line, and as soon as the patient's discharged, they perfect their lien and serve it.
So they generate the paperwork based on discharge, and then they just automatically file it with whoever the insurance carrier is?
Okay. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Cromwell.
What is the lien against again?
It's against insurance funds. So if the individual, and the lien is only good against certain types of such as no-fault insurance, so like PIP carriers,
right,
which would be obligated to pay out the funds for whatever the limits were of the policy for medical services rendered to their insured.
Okay. And follow up, Mr. Chair?
You may.
And so a doctor or a hospital or a provider, which actually they're the only two listed in here, I guess, files a lien against the insurance company for the amount, and if there's a balance remaining, I don't see it in here, but if there's a balance remaining after the lien has been satisfied, or you know, is the remainder extinguished, I guess is what I'm trying to get at.
You mean are you talking about when the limits are extinguished? They're reached, but not all the liens have been satisfied.
Correct.
Well, then the insurance company's obligations are discharged at that time. They've paid out the limits of insurance, and they no longer have any obligation to their insured to pay. Then at that time, the insured, the individual that received the services, would still be obligated, not on that lien, but on the deficient amount that the hospital or the physician, the services rendered to them. So just for example, say that there were $11,000 in charges from the hospital, and the PIP limits for the individual were $10,000. The hospital's lien would be satisfied up to $10,000 by the PIP carrier. Now there's still a $1,000 deficiency left in their bill, which then the individual is still responsible for those charges. But the lien is not valid against the individual.
Representative Jensen had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just judging from what you're saying, it sounds like to me like the doctors are the ones that are not that are late in getting their liens filed.
I wouldn't say that they're late. They file it within
comparison with the hospital.
In comparison with the hospital has the records, and they produce the discharge of the patient. And the delay may be several days before the physician actually gets the paperwork from the hospital showing the discharge, and then being able to go in and calculate the cost of the services provided. And generally, they're always several days behind the hospital in filing the lien, yes.
Representative Jensen?
I thought it was the doctors that signed the patients out.
They do discharge them. They do write the discharge, but the hospital is actually the one.
Hard-pressed, I guess, to understand why they're behind the power curve on this.
Well, as I understand it, the hospitals are generally have the paperwork already prepared, and as soon as the patient is discharged, many hospitals have the administrative process there to file their lien. But even if it were in the reverse, where the physicians beat the hospitals in filing the liens, then the physicians would be under some of these insurance companies' procedures for paying out on these liens, the physicians would be receiving all the benefits and the hospitals would be losing out. So I think it...
But you wouldn't be here representing that discussion, would you?
No, I wouldn't be. I would be here for the physicians.
Yeah, one more, Representative Chair.
I just was wondering if we have anybody here from the hospitals.
Well, we don't. We don't, and it's not... I think because they didn't know about the bill,
because I've actually had a conversation with them about it at one point along the way. But there's no one else signed up. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you're intimating that the wait period be 30 days before any payment's paid out?
Well, it already says 30 days, and that's how the law runs. This House Bill 3362 is actually what it would amend what is how the law is codified at ORS 87.555. And this 87.555 is the procedure for perfecting and filing your lien. The actual statute that covers the time period for filing and serving the lien is at ORS 87.570, which provides a 30-day time period from the date of discharge in which the hospitals and the physicians, that's the time for them to file their lien with the county and then to serve it upon the insurer.
Yes, you may, Representative.
One question. I guess I'm still a little unclear. This is the normal procedure for PIP claims or for all claims?
For PIP and no-fault claims. It wouldn't be for if...
normal doctor services.
Normal doctor services, and these are only for services that are provided to an inpatient at a hospital.
Further discussion?
Question?
Okay. Representative Jensen.
Is there any kind of a principle in law about first in time?
Counsel?
If I might, with respect to this specific law that's being amended, it's my understanding that it's not necessarily changing the policy from first in time to pro rata, but clarifying that the policy has always been a pro rata distribution of these funds. And if you look at the original bill on line 24, you can see where there's a change of language, but not necessarily, as I read it, a change in the policy decision. So while you're correct, there is a policy in certain circumstances for first in line, first served. Here, the policy decision, whenever ORS 87.555 was originally enacted, was to do a pro rata share so that there's a 30-day window, everybody files their liens, everybody gets a piece of the pot of money, even if it's not enough to cover everybody. And I think what the witness is saying is that insurance companies have actually interpreted the language that we tried to put down in a policy decision here exactly the opposite to make it first come, first serve, and that the policy is not really being carried forth by the language that's here.
And I was going to bring up Mr. Monroe from the insurance companies, but I think he sensed I was, and he bolted for the door.
Pretty quick.
Yeah, he sure did, didn't he?
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah, well, that does seem, I understand that when it says in current language, without regard to the sequence of filing, it seems to me that a policy of paying as the liens come in is squarely at odds with even current language, because that is, in fact, giving regard to the sequence in which the liens are filed.
Further discussion? Any questions for Mr. Madigan before we release him? Okay. Thank you. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3362. Open a work session on
Thank
House
you.
Bill 3362.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brzezinski.
I'm going to go ahead and just move House Bill 3362 as is. I understand there may need to be a change that could probably be addressed on the Senate side, but I think at this point it's such a small change I feel comfortable moving the floor with a due pass recommendation and allow the Senate to make that minor change for concurrence on its way back.
Representative Brzezinski moves 3362 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? All right, call the roll here.
Representative
Barker? Aye.
Representative
Jensen? Aye. Representative Cromwell?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Shatterby?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House
Bill 3362 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Volunteer? Representative Anderson, want to carry it? Okay. Committee, just a reminder, and I know I've gotten a couple of you, we're not going to be available on Wednesday for our afternoon, early evening session. I've gotten a note from both Representative Crummell and Ackerman who have in-district obligations that evening. So it'll be important that the balance of us are here in order to maintain a quorum so we can conduct business. We're going to start that meeting at 6 because we're going to have a floor session, as you'll recall, that goes till 5:30. So then we'll be here at 6 o'clock on Wednesday. Anything else for the good of the order? If not, then we'll be adjourned.
I may be here.